Clara Schumann is all but forgotten except to people who work in musical spheres, and even then to very few of them. She tends to be known by pianists because that was her job. And sure, there is an element of Clara's life that is about being, well, her later life, that is about being eclipsed by her husband. But women in general, people in general, fascinate me, and what their priorities are and how they work them out. And I think, having come through the later part of the 20th century, a centuries-old tradition, a centuries-old craving of women's lives in particular, which was to succeed by making their men shine, was in danger of being utterly eclipsed as pointless, stupid, and useless. And I think that's a damn shame. I think that, you know, that is labour too. That is something to put into the world and something to give. And Clara Schumann had this awful dilemma. On the one hand, she wanted, don't we all, to be a good girl. She wanted to do what was expected of her. She wanted a pat on the head from her father. She wanted her husband to love her. And what her society, 19th century Germany, told her was that to do that, you don't shine. Never stand in a man's light. It is the worst sin possible. She wrote that herself. This at the time when she was a Europe-wide famous pianist, the most famous piano virtuosa of the 19th century, the equal of Liszt and Thalberg and Rubinstein and Chopin, the equal of Paganini, he himself said it. This is a woman who is singular. What do you do when someone falls in love with you, when you're at the height of your fame at the age of 16? What do? You try to snuff yourself out of it. You try to make yourself slightly less conspicuous, but at the same time, the way to keep your father's love is to keep yourself burning bright, because his reputation depends on you. And that terrible dilemma is not, oh, correct me if I'm wrong, particularly ladies in the audience, which is most of you, well done, sir. I appreciate it. One of the things that I think still foxes people, particularly people of my generation, which most of you seem to be, is how do you overcome this dilemma of the part of you that knows that being a good girl means staying small? You know, I think, who was it? Was it Jermaine Greer said, everything about femaleness we are taught to appraise as being small. No woman wants to be told she has a twat like a horse collar. Nothing about it is meant to be big and expansive. Whereas chaps, again, much to their detriment very often, are expected to go out in the world and be that big, expansive person. And if that's not natural to you, what do you do with that? So I hit bingo with this couple. I got a man who was not at all comfortable with being centre stage when it was expected of him. And a woman who was very comfortable with being centre stage, but who knew that this was not really the approved way to be. And this is a dilemma I feel is still very, very much with us. How do you live out your life and still feel you are approved of? That's a particular female worry, is being approved of. For Robert, it was how simply to live out his life. The man she eventually married suffered from a series of debilitating mental illnesses so bad they eventually committed him to a mental asylum in which he died. He didn't die of mental illness. Very few people die of the direct effects of a mental illness. But his illness has never been analysed, and it seems to have been a mixture of tertiary syphilis, chronic bipolar disorder, psychotic delusions, which probably means he suffered from psychoaffective disorder, and anorexia. In some ways, it's kind of something very female about Robert, which made him someone that I found very, very interesting to write. So to kind of play devil's advocate, after that terrific introduction where women and women's lives seem to be part of what I'm interested in, most of what I'm going to read tonight is about two men. The first of them is Friedrich Wieck, Clara's father. You cannot discuss Clara Schumann without discussing her father. You can't really discuss without discussing her mum either. But I'm pushing all the women to one side tonight. And here comes Dad. And what happened to Clara even before she was born? What made her the woman she was largely down to Dad. Sing. One word. Sing. She doesn't speak, has never spoken, 4 years old and not a word. Some people say she's deaf or simple, others that she's both, but they'd be wrong. This child takes instruction, clears her plate. She comes when she is called, eventually. She doesn't laugh much and, thank God, seldom runs. She's not as clumsy as most her age and has no perceptible need of toys. As for her silence, well, here the man of the house draws himself to his full height, 5'6". Some would call that an admirable trait in a woman. What's more, she can find her own way home blindfold if the need arose. It's a plain house, neither elegant or grand sufficient. That's the word that springs to mind. This house is pleasingly adequate. There is a door and matching shutters and dutiful looking green, 10 solid apartments and loft space. All are necessary. There are music rooms, workshops, a warehouse, a spread of bedrooms, a sitting room, a parlour, a kitchen, one servant's room, one servant, three big windows, 11 pianos. That's what bulks up the space. Pianos. They're not slight beasts, not dainty. Varnished edges sharp enough to cut, snap shut lids, shin battering pedals, stops, stands. Watch boys lifting them for transport and you'd see pianos, even the small ones with painted lids and silver candle sconces, all nymphs and weeping shepherds are brutes. Unwieldy lumps. Stand between them and they crack, moan, breathe out wood. A little girl could get lost among their brown bull legs. That she never does is just as well, because the pianos keep coming. In trades, one puts one out for hire and two more appear. Teaching, trade, sale and barter, livelihood, aspiration. This house is made of pianos. That's what people come here. The hall is full of silhouettes. They're cheaper than miniatures. One bears a passing resemblance to Schubert. Another one is clearly Beethoven. Everybody's got these. As for the rest, Lord knows who they are. But trying to concentrate, to think in this place is impossible. This house has no peace. It rings and resonates, echoes from all its corners, pianos, voices. During the day, all day, the music rises. If you stand over the practice room ceiling up high in the floorboards or somewhere else, you can feel it buzz beneath the soles of these canvas shoes. Johanna is always there, but rocking a crib, building a pyre of sticks for a fire, and grating something green. Ivory inlays, fresh covers for naked keys, scatter the table like dead giant's teeth. These things are particular. The very look of them fills her with warmth. Treasure. Not that she knows the word herself. She calls nothing anything, not yet. Princess, hero, fairy tale, exactly the same. Why should she know? No one reads to her. Johanna has never learned, and in any case uses speech like pepper, sparing, seldom, sometimes not at all. Vic reads. He reads a great deal, but only to himself, and things so tedious, he sometimes throws them at the wall and goes out walking to escape. Once he lived on bread and water, hid his shirt cuffs in public lest the fraying show, but he built his life with unswerving dedication and selfless effort, and now, well, look at him. He signifies. Music changed his life forever, and he'll tell the story to anybody he's not proud. 6 free lessons from Notchmeyer, and his destiny, he says, was altered. Notchmeyer was a cripple in a metal crate, but a great man nonetheless. Schwarr too, and Weber. Great men all. Great men have shaped our lives. He's in a good mood when he tells him. His face looks less solid. He doesn't read to her, perhaps, but he tells her tales about his life, great men, and Jesus. If she can't hear or comprehend hopes or loss, he can speak enough for a household. This is the voice of one trained to know and disseminate the will of God. So who needs to add or interrupt? He speaks because he speaks. He does it very well. He'd tell an empty room, perhaps, and the child is at least Mother doesn't read because she is a singer. And her name is pretty as a petal, Marianne. That's everything there is to know. Everybody, Friedrich and Marianne, the other man and papa, Alvin and Gustav are only little boys, they make too much noise and neat things all the time. And nobody mentions Adelheid. Adelheid had no birthdays. That is there to say. The Lord giveth, etc., and acceptance is a lesson that man may avoid. After that, there's only Johanna. Johanna smells of fat and ashes. Her breasts are a mattress of flesh. When she reaches behind for the buttons at the back of your dress at night to an arm on either side, you can hardly breathe. Johanna cooks and mends. She washes, irons and starches, she clears the grate and leads it, builds fires, polishes brass, wood and iron surfaces, washes glass with vinegar. She orders kitchen supplies, deals with tradesmen, draws up household inventories, minds children, arranges hair when necessary, makes shirts, aprons, caps, slippers and bibs. Johanna sews. She cleans your teeth at night, the length of her pinprick fingers, slathered. After years, decades, the child these hands minister to will be able to conjure their owner at will. She will be able to recall the smoothness of Johanna's face, the smell of her, heavy as last week's soup, that her eyes were grey. No matter how hard she tries, nothing. Johanna didn't speak enough to leave a trace. She's been told again and again, didn't speak so you'd notice the approval with which it was said. And again, she must have said something. At least now and then, she must have uttered their names, her name. How do you discipline a child without using her name? Clara. It means limpid. Light. My father chose it. Clara! Say it! Clara! He holds a watch in front of her face. It swings to and fro in a chain, gold or brass perhaps. It's beautifully polished. The child's eyes with half her face dark. They tilt at the corners. Like a slav's. Clara! You may hold Papa's watch if you see it. Swinging his watch like Mesmer, repeating her name. Cleachin. Little Clara. My Clara. He's quite a man, Friedrich Leek. And he knows exactly. Even before the child was born, this is the destiny he has in mind for him. He's a piano teacher, you see. After Napoleon, it became possible just not to stay in the one place. We still have to learn this in Scotland in so many ways, but it became possible to do and be other things, and Vic was right there, right onto it. He saw what was going down. He saw that people were making money, that the bourgeoisie were acquiring the trappings that said, we have made the money. And what could you buy that was utterly useless and cost a lot of money? A piano! Then what did you do? You discovered you'd bought something useless. You needed a piano teacher. And you set the aforementioned on your daughter. So he saw a great way to make money. But there were so many young men who at one time would have been farm labourers, who had taught themselves music and were out there making a name and making money. He needed somebody to show off the craft. And that's what Clara was for. She succeeded far better than even Vic had an idea. But of course, once she succeeded, you saw how much more money you could make by having a team that drove around the house. And his pride in his daughter was absolutely extraordinary. So along, when the little girl is 9, she has a debut at the Command House. It's not her own concert. Please don't get carried away. 9 is just a bit too young for that. 10 when you have your own concert. She had her own at 10, By the time she's 11, Dad decides she's ready for Paris. Now, look, Paris is the centre of the musical world, you know? Europeans at the time talked about world famous, and they meant as far as Moscow to the north and as far south as Vienna. They didn't really count anywhere else. America was an outlandish place full of Red Indians and things. There was certainly money to be made there, but only in very limited ways. And the world was Europe. And the middle of the world was Paris. So many Parisians still believe this. extraordinary hangover. And that's where Paganini was. That was where Liszt was hanging out. Liszt, the famous Hungarian, who ran around in a hussar's outfit and never spoke a word of Hungarian in his life. He only spoke French. Chopin, who was the Polish son of a French emigre going in the other direction, running away from the revolution. He decides to come back because he ends up with this unlikely job of playing the piano too. That's where they all are. They, at this time, are 21. They were born 10 years before her. The extraordinary number of them are born dead 10 years before Clara Schumann. The one who will become Clara Schumann, Clara Wieck, including the man who will become her husband. But nobody has heard of Robert Schumann. And Robert Schumann has made a trip in the opposite direction. Here's how much business nous he has. He has gone to Italy. Nobody in the right mind at the time is hanging around in Italy, not even the people who are born there. Paganini goes straight to Paris. Just what you do. Robert just doesn't have it. He just doesn't kind of know what's going down. And Wieck does. So he and his daughter decide to go to Paris, and roughly the same week they decide to do that, by sheer fate, if you believe in such things, by sheer fluke, if you don't, up turns a young man, aged 21, 10 years older than his daughter, saying, "Can I have lessons?" He has had his mum send a letter. He has had his mum say, "My son is a very special boy." I know he seems a bit like a goofball, but actually he's a very gifted pianist and he's been studying law. You can imagine the reaction. No one in Robert Schumann's family. They're from a tiny place called Zwickau, which is now in Poland. It's crossed over the border. But at that time, it was so tiny, there was a bookshop, and Robert's dad owned the bookshop. And the only job in the town, basically, was being in the bookshop. So they thought Robert was going to make a life in books. It certainly is an avid reader. But he's desperate to play the piano. Nobody can work out where the hell this has come from. Absolutely desperate to play the piano. So they think, "Oh, who do we get? Who's that man we've heard of? The one in Leipzig? Wieck, he's got a daughter, we'll send him to him. Send him to him. He can teach a little girl to play, he can teach our boys to play." But not immediately. To begin with, what do they say? "Come on, stick up is like a Drosden." You know? They say, "There's nae money in music, son. Don't do it. Study." What makes money? The law. Study the law. That's it. The law and medicine have enormous ties with music. Because an awful lot of these poor chaps were sent to study either law or music because their families were desperate to make a bob or two and they saw they were smart. But being smart doesn't mean you can make money. And Robert insists. He tries. He goes to Leipzig and he studies law, but he's rubbish. He goes to Heidelberg and he studies law, and he's still rubbish. So eventually, Mum, after the death of Dad, Mum says, "Okay, son, it's your life. We will give you your share of the money your dad's left, and you go and study music." She writes to Wieck, and what impresses him? The mention of the money. So he takes all of Robert's money, and he puts him as a lodger in the house. I'm saying the rest of the story, it's always the lodger. So in comes Robert Schumann. Clara Josephine Wieck is at this time 11 years old, and her father announces she's going on tour to Paris, and Robert's world more or less ends. To date, what Wieck did, he sowed the seeds of his own undoing. He decided to teach the young man discipline. I mean, we have a pretty wild individual here. He drinks too much. He injudiciously, casually has sex right, left and centre with anything that stays still long enough. And at that time, that included young men. It was just one of these things. It was just a taken for granted. In the 19th century, where you reduce the sexual opportunities for meeting young women in your class, young men can come to each other and call it excessive passion. It's not what we call it now, but it was what they called it then, and it was quite a normal thing. Wieck hears all this. Of course he does. Leipzig isn't that big either. You know, we're moving from a dross into air. It's really not that big either. He hears stuff. He knows what's going on. He also sees that the young man is not entirely in control of himself. He has kind of trembling fits and shaking. He behaves strangely. But what he does to teach the young man discipline, which would be this, is he sits him on the same piano stool. He gets a double piano stool, and he sits the young man, 21 years old, next to an 11-year-old girl, and says, "Watch her learn something." To Robert's eternal credit, instead of taking the huff, he does. He sits and he watches the little girl, and what he learns persuades him that she has something he needs, that he needs more than anything else in the entire world. In his later diaries, he confesses he's in love with her by the time she's 12. This is an unsayable thing in the 21st century. I'm sure he meant it. I'm absolutely sure he meant it. But of course, there's nothing wrong with the sexual end at all. She's the wrong class to entertain that kind of thought with. And so when Deep decides to pack up his little girl and head to Paris, to have the career that Robert was hoping for, but clearly is not shaping up well for, it's like the end of the young man's world. And this, I was going to say, if it had been February, if it had been Valentine's Day, I would have given you the first kiss. But I burst into tears, so I shan't. And I'll give you instead what Robert's like when he's alone. Would you want your daughter being pursued by this man? On his last day in Leipzig, at their house, though she wouldn't know it until she was a woman with children of her own, Schumann sneaked into Clara's already abandoned room and flicked through her drawers and papers. Her handkerchiefs smelled of starch, her old diaries already a stack of linen. He read more than he should, but she was a child. She hadn't the same need of privacy as an adult. It wasn't spying. And besides, he really needed to know. She was, it was true, she was 12 years old, really and truly, quite so. Clementine, Wieck's second wife, was pregnant again and saw them off as far as Bitterfeld with the children. Schumann stood beside her, waiting. She recalls his face, or thinks she does, growing smaller, whiter, the interior of the coach, a black frame surrounding his shrinking form. After that, she thought of him hardly at all. If he got drunk for 3 days solid, wrote letters to himself, passed out, played Bach till he was dizzy, wept and laughed alone in his terrifying new rooms, she knew nothing of it. Not then. A poet and a hero. Christ. Christ. Gone 6 months, what did she do? She went to Weimar Airport, Gotha, Eisenach, Arnstadt, Kassel, Frankfurt, Darmstadt, Metz, Paris, Metz, Saarbrücken, Frankfurt, Hanau, and Fulda. She learned faces, times of day, the different smell of another country's streets, the mean dispositions of foreign hotels. She travelled with her father. She played the piano. What did he do? Well, he moved rooms twice, played, wrote, rejoiced, despaired, and masturbated till his wrist cramped. He read a great deal. He read about cholera and jaundice, typhus and flu. He studied Beethoven and cures for chronic skin complaints. He read Goethe, Bach, Herder and Wenzel and enough Shakespeare to cause indigestion. He scanned texts on nervous debility. He devoured Hoffmann and Heine, Schubert and Chopin, essays on syphilis, sight problems and gout. He read letters from his mother, full of blame made to sound like love, bad love letters full of exquisite, racking pain. He felt guilt, fear, shame, and loneliness. He worried. He didn't sleep enough. He read ghost stories and slept even more. He was rattled with sensibility. He drank too much, hated himself, drank more, lit cigars, sang till the small hours, and woke among sheets, spattered with bunholes, butt ends, trails of wine. He resolved to change. To change, to drink less, smoke less, spend less, and leave his cock alone. And so he did. Until the next time, when it started all over again, again, again. Many times he wished for a soulmate, a dear friend, a brother in thought and spirit, someone as unlike his real brothers as possible. Some men were married and settled by his age. They were famous. Mendelssohn was the darling of London. Chopin had two concertos under his belt. Mozart, Jesus Christ, Mozart didn't bear thinking about. Some were in the army. Just thinking about the army brought him out in a rash. He dreamt they came to get him, all uniforms and bad boots and bayonets, and he told them he had bad eyesight and they drafted him anyway. He woke sweating, sick, white. For comfort he read his diaries, and no comfort came. It was just as he thought. He was getting worse. A year ago, there it was in black and white, he'd felt fit to trust his luck. He'd given up his law books, landed the teacher of his choice, set his heart on music. At last, to celebrate, he'd had his portrait painted. It chanced upon variations by a young Polish composer in an out-of-town music shop and couldn't believe his ears. Thus fortified, he had played for the charity student at Beek's, a mezzo with a dark voice who had followed him back to his rooms, who had come inside without waiting to be asked, who had slid her finger into his mouth to stop him suggesting she sing. Christelle, sweet Jesus, a mouth round a thumb. He had his books, he had this brilliant new Chopin's music, he had a woman. This was something wholly expected, unexpected, a woman. For the first time, he thought, he was a man. He wasn't alone, he was... what was he? The more he thought about it, the more the same answer came back. He was two. Everything meaningful sprang from duality, like Abelard and Eloise, like Hamlet, why not him? Some days his head raced with this new knowledge and he felt invincible, stuffed with being. Other days he felt melancholy, even withdrawn, a splitting that became more marked over the past 2 years. Now he understood this wasn't an inconsistency, it was a ripening. He was coming into his own as, patently, two people. Moreover, this maturing, or whatever it wasn't finished yet. One of these days, the two would merge and make one more, as he and Clara did when they played Schubert four-handed, the two of them side by side on the piano stool. And this perfected self would be Raro, Clara, Robert, a composite name that showed the fusion yet to come. That's who he was. These three things explained everything, all his striving and present being, his promised future. They held the codebook for how he might plot the novel of his life. For the first time, he could see it all and with dazzling precision. He could stand at his window, open the shutters wide, and see all the way to Alsace if he tried, all the way to America, the moon, the stars. He was at ease with himself, and to be at ease with oneself, what a feeling that was. His first piece newly published, his sheets stiff with sex, his head full of champagne, Herr Schumann felt stout as Napoleon. How long had it lasted? 2 weeks? 3? Then his cock started bleeding again. The novel, the opera, the poems dried up, and he turned 22. He put narcissus water and arsenic on his foreskin and stopped answering the door. He wept. 22, older than draft age, a marker on the road that led only forward, the path behind him melting into oblivion. On bad days, he suspected his youth was finished, his chances gone, his conscription to some lunatic skirmish on the Prussian border a foregone conclusion. On bad nights, he knew it for sure. 22. He drank himself senseless, burned candles, developed stomach cramps, and a cough. He had syphilis. He knew it. Every twitch was a spiroid infection worming deeper into his nervous system, his brain, his bones. When his mother wrote to him that Julius, the brother who looked most like his father, was coughing, moreover coughing blood, Robert recalled the portrait he'd had painted when he'd thought the world was at his feet and took to his bed, terrified. people were falling like skittles in Berlin. There was cholera. There was typhus. Christ knew what else. Cholera was the worst. You got cramps and dysentery first, then stools like rice water flaked with bits of your own intestine. He knew this. He knew more. He wished Clara would come home. It's not a well man. It's much worse before the end for those of you, don't it? I feel I've been talking for an awful long time. Maybe you would like to do something.
Well, I think this is a good chance for everyone here now to join in. And has anyone got any questions they'd like to ask Janice? Yes.
Where did you get your material from? Was it like your own imagination or did you?
That's a very hard question. I can answer it at two levels, and let's face it, I'm probably going to take the most circuitous. On the one hand, you just read lots. I involved myself in so much research because I think if you're going to write about someone who's had a real life, you owe that real life the respect of getting it as accurate as possible. So that meant I needed the chronology of that real life. Now, that's very easy with someone who was as famous as Clara Wieck Schumann. All the concert diaries are there. I can tell you what she played at every concert. I need to go back to my notes to do it, but the whole lot is there. I looked at her repertoire in order to find out how she may have put her thinking together. I tried to play some of the pieces, the easy ones I should have. Tried to play some of the pieces that were under her fingers daily. I tried to listen to the music she really liked. I listened to the music she wrote. She was also a composer in her own right. The music that influenced her enormously was largely Chopin. She was a huge admirer of Chopin, who had no time, as he put it, for German women. German women are of no interest. There's the Polish French for you. By definition, he thought German women were lumpy. And all her life she suffered a bit from... Oh, one of the wonderful things I wanted to do in the book, actually, I didn't read it, but at the concert, is I've been drawing these analogies with Ayrshire, which is where I'm from, or the part of Germany they're from. I think you need to do these things which appear to be on the surface disrespectful, but which are actually a way of saying, transplant. Imagine this with people that you know around about you. And discovered, to my delight, that all her life, to my delight, a sadness for Clara, but to my personal, selfish delight, that all her life she had suffered from feeling her Leipzig accent was funny and lumpy. If you put on Radio 3, as I did last week, and you listen to a play that has Clara Schumann in it, it's a play about Brahms, the life of young Brahms, and Clara using, and she's talking like that. She talked like that all the way through it. And I don't think Clara Schumann ever in her life talked like that. I think she probably talked a lot more like me. In fact, probably even cursor, actually, when it got down to it, than me. She had a gruff, heavy Leipzig accent. She wasn't moneyed. But somehow we do this. We appropriate the great and the good, and we make them posh. They were never posh. They are artisans. They could never be posh. The posh looked down on them. The posh saw them as liveried entertainment. They put them into monkey suits to entertain them. And that was one thing she was never going to do, was be liveried entertainment. But she kept her mouth shut as often as possible. So that was a real way into Clara Schumann. So when you say, did you make it up? I did all this pots of research. I studied the lives of Mendelssohn, one of her greatest friends, of Brahms, of her husband, quite clearly, of Wieck, of Paganini. I ended up spent Amazon.co.uk owe me in patronage. I spent millions of pounds in books and I Xeroxed loads of stuff. I read books on German politics. I got Robert Schumann's autopsy report. I read books on mental illness. I read books on the progress of the railways in 19th century Germany. Geez, now there is the cure of it. Extraordinary the amount of research you need to do. Well, you need to do if you're me. And in the middle of doing all this, I met Jim Crace. Do any of you know Jim Crace's work? His most famous book is probably Quarantine. Jim, lovely, lovely man. He's from Birmingham. And Jim said, so what are you doing the way people do? He said, you don't need to answer that. You know, it's quite rude to say to a writer, what are you doing? So they're lounging about having holidays or something. He said, you can answer that if you like. Yeah. I said, I'm in the middle of doing all this bloody run of doing this, that, and the next thing. And he said, for Christ's sake, you're a writer, make it up. And that's very much Jim's approach. And of course, these are the two general shapes and options. He wrote a book about the life of Christ and made every single word of it up. Me, I had to go and stand at Leipzig train station just to feel, you know, just to imagine the steam. It's just a difference in temperament. So one is not righter than the other, but I felt I needed to do that. And then I thought, bugger me, I've got millions of notes, but I can't feel them yet. And what I did, this is a wonderful thing to do, this is a great carry-on for those of you who are writers, I wrote to the Victoria and Albert and said, can I try on one of your frocks? And they let me! Now you put it on. They gave me the wrong one because it had big sleeves. And suddenly all sorts of things dawned on me. You can't play the piano in these. So you must have had the frock specially made. You can't even walk in one of these bloody things. They weigh a ton. And there's a bit right at the beginning of the book, because that was where I first found it, is putting on clothes. One layer after another. And women used to build the most extraordinary cage around themselves before they were an edifice ready for public consumption. And that was the way I got into Clara Schumann as much as possible. Getting into Robert, much easier, because he left exhaustive diaries. Robert Schumann didn't masturbate without writing it in his diary. I knew rather too much about Robert Schumann. But of course, you can't trust it all. But one of the things they did, he insisted when they got married that they would keep a marriage diary. Her great friend Mendelssohn had done this. Mendelssohn married a 15-year-old, right enough, and she was terribly Cecile was very, very gullible and very, very French, and of course, being French already had the cachet points. Clara felt really lumpy, clod hopping beside her. But she's, of course, marrying a German and doesn't feel so badly about it. And he insists that they keep a diary, since they don't talk much. Even as a married couple, they didn't speak much. They wrote letters to each other. In some ways, that's wonderful, because I can read them. In some other ways, you mustn't trust these letters. Because you find in the diary, there is him writing the very first entry, and it's beautiful. I've quoted it verbatim in here, where he says, this will be the catalogue of our hopes and dreams. I mean, the most beautiful, elegant turn of phrase. It looks very purple now, but at the time it would have been amazing. And they were going to keep the catalogue of their lives in it. And they would pay a forfeit. And whoever doesn't write the diary after a fortnight will have to give the other one a kiss. And it's all very charming. And he writes this on the day of their marriage. However, he writes the first one, she writes the next one. He writes the next one, she writes the next one. He writes the next one, she writes the next one. She writes the next one, she writes the next one. He writes one, she writes five. He writes one, she writes 10. Eventually, you realise Robert's got fed up. He's doing other things. He's beginning now, he is a married man, to push himself to write symphonies because they earn more money. A symphony is a novel, you must understand. Piano pieces are poetry, they earn nobody any money at all. So he's pushing himself to write things that are going to earn him some money. And he begins to disappear. So Clara keeps on writing the diary. But because Clara has so little confidence in her education, she almost had none except what her father gave her in music, she's writing, "We had fish, wore my blue dress." It's as dull as ditch water. And then he comes along and says, you know, put in who we had to dinner. You see him writing a little note. Almost as though he's tutoring her in writing. So she'll write, well, Mendelssohn and Cecile came and I made the hake and it was a bit burnt. It's all tiny little domestic details. And then eventually she starts saying, well, and I had this concert. Well, wait till I tell you about this. And it starts to become really conversational. What happens? Robert writes up the side, this is not of interest. This is a diary for posterity. Tell them about our friends. And that kind of smack back, you realise you can't trust these diaries. That he is shaping them for posterity and trying to make them sound as you would have if you'd been 19th century. We mustn't look down on him. He wasn't being petit bourgeois. He wasn't being bourgeois aspirant. It was just what one did. You appeared to look grander. It was like his telephone voice is what you're getting in the diary. And Clara just doesn't know. And even when she does kind of go freelance, she's smacked back in her place. And you can see clearly that they also begin to have domestic arguments. Because some days there is nothing at all, or she writes, I cannot write it this week. And eventually the diary stops, and that was a cracker, because I felt I was doing my duty by her and researching, but saying, love, you're trying to tell me something you can't write down. So who? So the only one person like, that's what I'm for. And that is when you can get in there, you can get into the spaces in the diary, you can get into the white space. I'm a great believer in white space. There are great chunks of white space here for, I hope the reader's going to come in and flesh it with their experience. In their marriage diary, in her letters, there are great chunks of white space where she leaves room for you to come in and say, what would I have done in that situation, knowing what I know of her? So, yes, partly it's made up. Mostly when letters are written, they are my translations from German. Now, my German is not impressive, so that did leave me a lot of room to make things up. That's okay, I think. The most beautiful of Robert Schumann's love letters, I already kind of knew off by heart because I had read them so much, and in English translation, in good English translations. But it was important for me to sit with the German and struggle through it to the best I could, because there is a poetry to 19th century German that doesn't translate readily at all, and I wanted to get that kind of strange thing. Because his most famous thing was the year they got married, he almost burst like a nightingale with songs. He wrote song after song after song, six in a day sometimes, which is writing, it's like writing six poems in a day. It's unbelievable rate of creation, and I wanted to get that sing-song voice in him, so it was easy for him to listen to the music. And for the other ones, it's always a squish writing bad boys list. Absolute doddle, you know, you get the hussar's uniform and then you get the hair and you're off, you've got this. Clara actually gave me the clue for list. She put, if he tosses his head in this concert one more time, I am leaving. He's that kind of strange head-tossing thing that he did. Chopin, of course, everybody has a picture of Chopin being bloody lunged and pale, and actually he was very much like that, and very quiet, kept himself to himself. His own private life, if you read his erotic letters, do are absolutely luridly filthy. So he clearly had another self, and maybe that's why he was so pale. Let's face it. But there is another side to Chopin, so if you read enough of that, you can get that kind of thing into. But bad boys are easy. Those of you who are writers won't know this. Bad boys are easy. We have been trained to see bad boys as interesting. Who are difficult are the sad boys. Schumann was much harder to write than the bad boys. And who are very difficult indeed are the good girls. Oh, extraordinary. Without making them sound boring, without making them sound pious, without making them sound holier than thou. Very, she was a beast. So it's mostly research, but research taken as kindling. But you've got to set it on fire or nothing's going to happen. And fire is the bit that I have to put into it. That was a long answer, I'm sure.
How long did it take?
Start to finish? Ooh, this is a lifetime's work, you understand. Physically, it was 6 years. It was 6 years from when I decided stop fanning about. I mean, I was writing little bits in the persona of somebody. I knew perfectly well it was Clara Schumann, but I was kidding when I didn't know who it was to myself, because I didn't want to start a novel. You know this. You know this very well. This is Paola, with whom I'm acquainted. I think I may say that. I've been kind of kidding myself. I wasn't going to write a novel. Some writers love doing that. You know, they have started something and they like jumping in. I believe Jeffrey Archer is like that. Some writers aren't like that at all. Some writers will do anything. It's like pulling your intestines down your nose with a crochet hook, you know, and you will go a long way to avoid confessing that what you're doing is actually starting a novel, because it's a long sit. And I knew this one was going to be a very long sit. So I began with research. It's very easy to kid yourself on doing research that you're doing hard work. Haha, you're just reading other people's books. You're kind of storing up information, but it's not the same as writing it yourself. And I had a great stroke of luck in that I went to Leipzig, and I had a laptop case full of notes, and some poor bugger thought it was a genuine laptop and stole it. And 3 years' worth of notes just... Oh. Went like that. So when I realised I wasn't going to throw myself off a tall building, I decided that was I had to do something, and it was time to stop pussyfooting about, actually start. So that was the start, otherwise I would probably still be researching it. So it did take 6 years. I've also been asked, why does it finish where it does? It took 6 years to get to page 423, and that's halfway through her life. less than halfway through her life. Seriously, if anyone's going to ask me, why didn't you take it through and finish and write the whole life? You want a bigger book than this? Because I sure didn't. I was dog tired by the time I got to page 426. And also, it's based on a song cycle by Robert Schumann. I wish I'd bought Found Nemo playing with me tonight. Do any of you know the song cycle? It's one of these horrible moments where somebody says, have you done your Sunday school homework? This beautiful song cycle, which is a beast in this day and age. I've heard Anne-Sophie von Otter make perfect sense of it. But it's a horror for a woman in this day and age to try and pull off. It's the first song, it's Zeichen gesehen. Since first I saw him, glaube ich blind zu sein, I've been blind. It's a woman's life and love. Love. Frauen lieben und leben. It's her life and love. Her life begins when? Seit ich ihn gesehen, glaube ich mir zu sein. When I first clapped eyes on him. Mm-hmm. We none of us need to ask who him is. Mm-hmm. It is the object of one's affection, and that is when, ladies, our lives begin. And that is when the lady in this song cycle her life begins. The next song is Ich kann's nicht fassen. Oh, it's not. It's der herrlichste von allen. He's the very best! Simply the best. It's a, you know, it's a kind of Carly Simon pastiche that we have there. The third one is Ich kann's nicht fassen. That's the, I can hardly believe it. He's looking at me. Be still, my foolish heart. In words to that effect. The fourth one is He's asked me to marry him. Der Ring an meiner Finger. The next one is Helft mir, ihr Schwestern. Help me, dear sisters. And it's to put her wedding dress on. But it was the title of Helft mir. Help me. In conjunction with the idea of marriage, that really made me again get a key into Clara Schumann. She had the most disturbed, frightening, fearful, as well as loving marriage. She had the most extraordinary gamut of things happen to her in the marriage. And I thought, why not take this song cycle and apply it to the real woman in the real composer's life? So, Seit ich ihn gesehen is dad, since first I beheld him. That was about dad. The next one, der herrlichste von allen. His father is the best of all because she has made him a reputation. Ich kann's nicht fassen is when Robert turns up, and so on. And it goes through the last song of the song cycle is now for the first time you're giving me pain because the husband dies. So the woman's life in the song cycle ends when her husband dies, just as it began when she met him. Unfortunately, I could say there is also an artistic reason as well as a fatigue reason finishing at page 200. 426, because that is when it concludes when Robert dies. So you've got two answers, one to a question nobody asked, and one to a question somebody did.
Was it very emotional when you asked it with
a
change
of
people?
Anger
on
behalf? Awful, yes. Not so much anger. Clara was not a creature prone to anger. They don't call it Germano-British upbringing for nothing. And yes, a lot of. If I just keep very, very quiet and calm myself down, everything will be all right. Goes on in it. My own upbringing was full of that. So again, that was a handling to her. Just keep quiet, kid on, you don't see the things you're seeing. When I was coming round tonight, there was a man with a little baby. Well, not a little baby, maybe about 18 months. And it was exactly that thing I saw for a lot of my own childhood, which was in Salkitts. He's screaming at the kid, what did you do that for? What did you do that for? And starting to shake him. The kid is 18 months and wearing a leather jacket. And he grabs the leather jacket on his shoulders and shakes the kid. And the mother runs up, or the woman runs up, and grabs the kid as he falls out of the leather jacket, holds the kid, and she starts screaming at him. And I thought, you know, here we are. There is somebody else learning. If I just make myself invisible, everything will be all right. Clara's upbringing, for completely different reasons, was one like that. If I just completely thought about it, nothing will happen. So it was more a kind of, yes, it was very emotional, but it was more a, it was a kind of implosion job. When there were nights, I don't drink very much. That always sounds like protesting too much, but I really don't drink very much. I'm at a funny age and it makes me too hot. So I don't drink too much. And some nights I would just need to sink a bottle at least to get it out somehow. I would sometimes write and think, what the hell is that? And discover I was crying. Because again, I'm awfully good at repression. And if you're not actually doing it on purpose, it's okay. Tears happen by accident. Yes, it was a very, very emotional book to write. Writing the death of Robert scene was awful. I could only do it like a couple of sentences at a time. Kind of wandered away, which was, it was very difficult. That's the straight answer to it.
Will you finish your life story?
Sorry?
Will you finish a life story?
Well, I mean, I have thought about it. You know, Clara 2, The Return. could possibly be. I have thought about it because, of course, the whole of the next bit, what happens is that the young Brahms turns up in her life, and I thought, cool, imagine writing Brahms. Yeah, there's a totally paradoxical creature. You know, you can go to town with someone like Brahms, but I've still got this annoyingly very good woman to take forward with me, who becomes slightly less good after the death of her husband. But hangs on for grim death. You know, and that was where we started. Remember you said about women that she has become less well-known. In some ways, that was her ambition. She didn't know it. But he died obscurely. He starved himself to death in a mental asylum, and no one was playing his music because they heard he'd gone nuts and it was embarrassing. No one was mentioning him. And she had the nerve to go on concert platform after concert platform throughout Europe. She farmed the 8 kids out. In those days, you could do that. The guilt about motherhood was not cultivated into quite such a rare orchid as it is today. She farmed the kids out and went on tour. And she went on platforms and played his stuff. And she stood up in front of hostile audiences and defied them not to like it. And gradually, over 40 years, cataloguing his music, playing his music, he becomes more famous than her. And when a concert pianist dies before the age of recording, gone. What happened to Schumann? Kept going. In some ways, that is exactly what she was going for. She just hadn't thought it logically through that she would vanish and he would be left. But in some ways, the book is a testament to centuries of women who have done just that, who've said, that is my life, is making something special of someone else's life, of my children, of my man, of the people round about me. I think that's something too, and it was one of the sides of Clara I wanted to bring out, not necessarily the famous, dazzling, glitzy, extraordinary pianist, but this other passionate side of her that was about something else entirely.